This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. On today's episode, we discuss influential people in our lives. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. It's Christmas Eve, and we're back.
We're going to finish up the end of the decade episode, even though we've only been doing this for about a year. Last episode for the decade, last episode probably for the year. And we're going to talk about influential people. And, I mean, I've been doing jiu-jitsu since 2011. So, I mean, that's almost a decade. You've obviously been doing it for much longer. But
yeah, been doing karate since 2000.
Yeah, so, we're going to talk about influential people, not only just, I guess, in martial arts to us, but maybe in our personal lives and other endeavors we've had.
Yeah, you know, and kind of in the spirit of the season, you know, just, you know, people that were influential and people that were really grateful that, you know, we had around us and we had as an influence on us. Maybe not even people that we knew personally, but just people that were really influential to our lives and especially influential to us as martial artists. So, you know, I, of course, have to start with my teacher, the Master David Kremen, and he's a Tung Sudo instructor out of Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And I started training with him when I was 9 years old, and he, you know, was a huge influence on my life. I mean, one of the main role models that I had in my life, you know, all the way up until now. It was especially very influential to me in my teen years, kind of, especially since I decided to become a teacher myself. He very much was the person that I was, you know, emulating. I looked at, kind of was looking at, you know, his life and what he was doing, and how it very much was something that struck me as like, you know, that's a life that I'd kind of like to live. You know, I'd like to, you know, live that karate instructor life where, you know, I'm working 4 or 5 hours a day, you know, teaching martial arts, positively influencing people's lives that way. And yeah, he was a great teacher, and I just eternally grateful for all the things that he gave me.
Yeah, so you're kind of in an interesting situation, I guess, because he's the only true, like, real instructor you've ever had, right?
Yeah, really the only one that I've stayed with for a very long period of time. I mean, the other guy that I, of course, talk about, you know, we've talked about plenty of times on this podcast is Ian Abernethy, but, you know, totally different relationship that I have with him. You know, he's a guy who I've been training with since 2014 now, so that's 5 years, you know, pretty long relationship I've had with him. But, you know, it's occasional. I attend his seminars when I can.
Yeah, so I train with him. Yeah, I think that's way different. That's not like, you've had one actual primary instructor.
Absolutely.
Which I don't know how uncommon that is in Tung Sudo or the karate world, but that's pretty uncommon in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
But
it's,
I mean,
pretty
again,
common in karate.
The average time it takes to go from white to blue or white to black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu is 10 years, and you live a lot of life in 10 years. So
sure. Yeah.
There's a lot of shift that happens in 10 years. So I wonder in 10 years if we did 10 years not looking at white to black belt in Tung Sudo or karate, whether we'd see the same shift. Like,
yeah,
how many,
I think,
people stay if they choose to train for 10 years or more? Yeah. How long do they stay with the same person?
I'm sure it's similar. It's similar with people who start as adults. The point is, you know, you move, you get a different, you know, there's any number of reasons that you're unable to continue training with your, with your first instructor, and then you go and you train somewhere else. But I think that one of the reasons why it's more common in karate is just because so many more people are starting as kids. It's so much more the norm. Karate, I know it's becoming more the norm in jiu-jitsu, but, you know, I'd say still primarily adults doing jiu-jitsu, whereas karate is the opposite. It's primarily kids doing jiu-jitsu. So you start with an instructor, you know, whatever, you know, in whatever area, you know, you're growing up in, and then you kind of stay with them often until you go away to college, and maybe, you know, you never come back and live in that area anymore, so you don't really train with them anymore. But definitely something more common in karate, and there's also, I think, a little bit of a cultural element to it too. Less so now, maybe more than in the past, but it was often looked down upon if you were the kind of person that jumped from instructor to instructor. It was especially looked down upon if you were the kind of instructor that they would say it was like poaching students, where you'd try to like take people that were training with somebody else and then get them to come and, you know, practice with you. Yeah. That was considered like real, real low behavior in
all
karate
that,
world.
All that stuff is still a touchy subject in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, it's I can imagine why.
It's a big deal to... It's getting a little better, but like there's a lot of still mindset and approach of people that are like, you're a part of this association, you should only train with people in this association. If you're not, I forget what the word is, it's like Creoten or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm probably butchering it. That's what they call them or something like that.
Yeah.
People that switch teams or go and hop around and train anywhere with anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, still looked down upon for the most part. Yeah, it's getting better, but it used to be like
tribal, you know.
Yeah. You'd almost be like blacklisted if you were jumping around schools, you'd blacklisted, nobody would train with you anymore.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those cult elements you get in martial arts a lot of the time. Now, as someone who's a teacher, I know you're a teacher too, so I'd love to know your take on it. But for me, you know, I can definitely, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I don't agree with that kind of mentality or that is a cultural norm at all. I think it's my responsibility to retain my students. If my students are not, you know, satisfied with, you know, the instruction that I'm giving them and they go somewhere else, you know, then it's on me. You know, that at the end of the day, primarily. However, you know, I think that there can be elements of, I could say coercion a little bit, like taking advantage of a student's student being kind of naive about it. And then to be like, you know, cause they get to a certain level, you know, like they get to a certain level with the instructor they train with, and maybe they're struggling with certain things. And then they have a new guy who comes in and is telling them, wow, you're great. I see so much potential, and you're shows them some stuff they haven't seen before. Maybe easy for them to jump ship. You know, I can see how as an instructor that's something that people would, you know, be hurt by, you know, a lot. That you invest a lot of time in a student and then they leave and they go train with somebody else. But, you know, I just think that the healthiest way to approach it is, you know, I just have to be better in that way. I have to make sure that my students, you know, they really appreciate the things that I do, and I'm really, you know, I go out of my way to be the best instructor I can for them. So therefore, you know, less likely to just, you know, run off to somebody else. Yeah.
But part of that is also, if you're being the best instructor, sometimes you got to look at a student and be like, listen, this just isn't the fit for you.
Yeah, you're right.
You should go to this other place.
Absolutely.
What you're looking to get out of it, you're not going to get out of it here.
Sure.
You know,
we all have different takes on the martial arts. It's going to fit some people and it's not going to fit others. I agree.
Yeah. So, I mean, in jiu-jitsu, I've had the same primary instructor the whole time, Alberto Rubio, black belt under Horian, Huron and Henner Gracie.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone and learned from some other people, and there's really one person who I think is primarily like a person who I have spent the most time outside of working with Alberto on, which we'll talk about that person in a little bit. But Alberto's my instructor, and there's no question about that for me. I think that loyalty matters, and I think once you find the fit, there might be a certain point where you have to start looking outside for some things, or maybe you just need a different voice in your ear. But even within that, I'm really only going to one other person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I do think that loyalty and is very important. But, I also, without Alberto, I'm nothing, you know, as far as my jiu-jitsu self.
Sure.
I mean, multiple opportunities. And again, I mean, he would say that those opportunities were there for other people, and all of them decided not to take advantage of it, and you did, so it's really on you.
Yeah.
You made it happen, which I agree with to a certain extent, but
he still came here from Colombia and, you know,
yeah,
went through that whole process of starting a business. So
again,
big on him.
He still saw something in me and trusted me enough to give me the opportunity. So
sure.
I did the instructor certification program that the Gracie Academy has. Now I think it's called Gracie University. At the time, I shouldn't have gotten into it, because I did not, I just tested with Alberto. I didn't film a video and send it in. And that's what you're supposed to do in order to be an instructor. You have to send in the video of the techniques, and you have to get a certain score, and then you can do the instructor's program. This is all stuff that we don't do anymore because we're no longer an ICP, which means an instructor certified pretty much training center or whatever for the Gracie University, Gracie Academy. So I didn't submit a video because I hadn't, no, that wasn't on my like radar. I was just like, I just want to do jiu-jitsu. I just want to get good. Maybe I'll have some aspirations for teaching down the road, but I just want to go through the process.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed somebody, and other people declined. So the opportunity came, and he was like, listen, I'll call Huron and I'll tell Huron that this is a guy I see potential in, and he'll push you through. And that's pretty much what happened.
Awesome.
You know, so like, and again, I had to still take advantage of the opportunity. I had to do some things to prove that I was up to a certain level. I still had to put in a lot of work. But I went and I did that. And then I went to Los Angeles. I went to Torrance. I did the instructor certification program thing there. And we came back. And then I don't even know how long we were still a part of the Gracie Academy after that, because now the years are blending together. But I mean, it all happened relatively quickly. And again, it was kind of just like a perfect series of events that his school was young. He needed somebody. He had no higher belts. And I was a blue belt who seemed interested. So on some ways it was good. In some ways it was bad. One of the things that's good is that I got, from the point of a blue belt, I was being brought up to teach. And obviously I'm just a purple belt now, but I've been brought up with this idea of being a great instructor, so that in theory, by the time that I'm a black belt, I've spent probably 9 to 10 years teaching jiu-jitsu. So by the time I'm a black belt, I should be able to relay this information very, very well. You know?
And that's a really awesome approach to take. So I think it's something that happens a lot in martial arts. People don't appreciate how much teaching is a separate skill. You know, they think, and we've talked, I know we've talked about this on the podcast before. It's like, oh, you know, you're great at jiu-jitsu. You know, you could be a great teacher too. It's like, well, you know, being a great practitioner and being able to make other people great practitioners are very different skills. So it's something you got to put the time into.
Well, little foreshadowing to future episodes, talking about training mindsets. I think one of the things that people don't realize is that if you make the decision to be an instructor at any level, teach at any level, even if you're just teaching one kid's class a week, you end up sacrificing some of your own training time and some of your own investment in your own martial arts experience.
Yeah.
And that has some negative and positive effects on your relationship with the martial arts and your abilities with the martial arts, which is a whole different deep conversation to get into.
Yeah, it's a big one to get into.
But yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of, you know, he trusts me with his school. You know, I'm pretty much his right hand man. I can't foresee somebody else ever promoting me, unless there's some crazy thing that happens, which obviously we can't foresee the future. But he's pretty much the person that I view as my instructor and always will, and probably the person that will always promote me.
Yep. You know, Alberto gave me a really good piece of advice, you know, back when I was teaching for my teacher, Master Kremen, and Alberto was still, that's how we first met. You know, you were working for Alberto, I was working for Master Kremen, and Alberto was subletting from Master Kremen. You know, he rented the floor space so you guys could run your classes when we didn't have them. And that was when I was, you know, first, you know, making plans to go out and teach on my own.
Yeah.
And I asked him about, because I knew that, you know, that's what he kind of read. You know, Master Kremen, of course, he kind of, you know, came from an established organization in the area where we run our schools. So we kind of already had that structure and framework to work from like that. Whereas I knew that Alberto had a little bit of an interesting story where he was originally from Colombia, came to the United States. Lived in California and learned jiu-jitsu there with the Gracies, and then, you know, kind of came here and started running his own school. And I just asked him for a little bit of advice about, you know, the whole process of building your school from the ground up. And what he told me, it stuck with me a lot. They said, you know, like, it's a creative process. They said, like, people think of, you know, like a creative process being, you know, like making a painting or something like that. But he said that, you know, that like running a business, figuring out how to build a business, how to make it viable, is just like you have to be creative. You know, you have to really, you got to try different things, and you have to, you know, really put the time and the work in to it. And it was something that, I don't know, I feel like it's helped me a little bit. You know, I'm 5 years into running my own school now, and I've tried to keep that in mind, that, you know, you gotta be proactive in the way that you approach that business end of things. You know, you can't just sit back and kind of, you know, hope that things work out. You gotta go out and you gotta try different things. You gotta try to, and you know, big part of that, and something maybe I've latched onto more than anything else, is trying different things as a teacher, always trying to figure out how I can be providing a better service to my students, in the hopes that that will retain the ones that I have, and help me retain the students that I already have better, and will also help me to help to spread the word and get more people into my school. So, good piece of advice you gave, man.
Yeah. So going off into, like, I guess secondary people for me, as far as that have had an influential impact on me, Christian Woodmansey, who's a name that has come up multiple times if you guys listen to this podcast. And I actually don't even think that I expected to have him have such a huge impact on me. He was just a guy who I was a fan of, kind of because... I think it was at a world's competition. He was like awarded points, and he didn't deserve the points. Like he didn't complete the move successfully or something. And he went to the referee and was like, "Hey, I, you know, didn't protest." He was like, this is points I didn't deserve. You can't give me these points or whatever." And then ended up losing the match, but was very much like, you know, you need to keep your integrity.
Yeah.
Rather win with integrity than win some way that I don't deserve.
Yeah.
And he was, at the time, living in San Diego, but he's from, like, New Jersey. And he just happened to end up in a spot where he was the head instructor, now owner of a school that's called Logic. It used to have a different name. It was called Roots Athletics. And I was like, oh, well, he's teaching here, so I should just go and go private with him, because there's things that he does that he specializes in that we don't spend as much time in. So I'm intrigued by this position, so I'm going to do a private with him. And I was like, wow. I had taken some other privates, but like the experience with doing a private with him was just different, you know.
Yeah.
Very open in with me, and like being like, "Hey, listen, like, you know, you can contact me whenever, reach out to me whenever you have any questions, just ask them. You know, if you want to come back down again, just let me know." And then I came back down again, and I was like, "Hey." And then next thing you know, it was just very much like a, you're welcome here anytime. And I'm like, okay, so, you know.
That's awesome, yeah.
And now it's a person who over time, it's like, I mean, we've been hung out with each other, again, mostly in the jiu-jitsu setting, but it's like, I support anything that he does. If he's like, "Hey, I'm doing a charity toy drive," I'm like, "I'm there. And I'll try and mention it to everybody at our school. Hey, can you come teach a seminar at our school?" We've had him teach a couple seminars now at Milwaukee. And just like, you know, when he posts something that I think is viable and intelligent and things that I value and I think other people, I'll share it.
Yeah.
You know, he has a seminar, I'll mention it, all those things. But again, it's a two-way street, so.
Yeah, you got me on the, I follow his pages now too. He does post a lot of good stuff. He's a pretty deep thinker with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he posted the other day something which is just like, and I mean, one of the things that I've always liked about him is his frankness, which is just like, so many people want to kind of lie to their students and prop themselves up and their students up to being better than they are. And it's like, yeah. No, you're not good at this thing, and it's okay that you're not good at this thing.
Yeah.
Now, it's up to you whether you want to get better at that thing. And how do you get better at that thing? Well, I'll tell you the steps you need to take. You might not even need me to tell you the steps that need to be taken to get to this next level and fix this hole. Maybe you know yourself, but you have to be actually willing to go through the process. And if you're not, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. You just have to be honest with yourself.
Sure. Honesty.
Yeah, you know, and he said it pretty much as like, you think you have good jiu-jitsu, and then you go with somebody who actually has good jiu-jitsu, and you find out that your jiu-jitsu sucks. Yeah. And the difference between good and great is way bigger than you thought.
Sure.
And he's like, pretty much, and now you're left like crying in a corner or something like that.
Yeah, even moving away from jiu-jitsu with that, I think that...
That's just in life, period. Yeah,
life in period, and yeah. Also I was even saying martial arts in general, just being honest, you know, about your limitations, I think is really important. And it, because that's the first step to getting better. You know, a lot of time is, you know, being honest about where you're lacking. And I think that it's a symptom of the overall, like, martial arts culture that you have. I think we still, and it's becoming less as time goes on, but you still, like, have the remnants of that, like, 70s, like, kung fu theater, like, superhero martial artist type idea that, like, if you're promoting yourself as a martial artist, especially if you're a teacher or something like that, you need to have like a superhuman quality to you. And like, and whatever your weakness...
That's why you have instructors that won't train with their students.
Sure.
Won't train in front of their students, because then they're going to be revealed to be human.
And that kind of honesty is refreshing, you know. I think that it's definitely the kind of thing that is beneficial. And yeah, I went through it with the kind of direction I've gone with my training, where it's like you get to the point that you're pretty good at Tung Sudo, and it's easy just to stay in that bubble and be like, I'm just going to do Tung Sudo forever. I'm going to pretend that Tung Sudo does everything best, you know, like that. The reality is, it's like, I'm really grateful. It's a step that I took. It's like, okay, let's just honestly kind of assess that, like, hey man, there are a lot of things I don't know how to do at all. Like the entirety of grappling. And that's probably the best use of your time, I'd say, for a lot of people coming from karate or general striking background. It's just like, you know, kind of be honest with yourself. Like, yeah, you got vulnerabilities, man. You know, do something to approach them. Or if you're not going to do something to approach them, then just, you know, acknowledge them at least. That's a good thing to do.
I mean, his honesty with stuff is just, you know, I think that you go somewhere else, and sometimes, I guess it's different, because I initially went there thinking like, oh, I'll do a private with him, maybe if there's an open mat, I'll swing by, and then something changed where I was like, I kind of drop by there semi-regularly, which almost makes it like a secondary place for me to train. And like, mm-hmm. It's one thing if I run into those guys in like a traditional tournament mm-hmm. setting, but like I would never take any sort of like super fight style thing against one of his students ever under any circumstance.
Not even
if I never train with him again, I wouldn't do that just because of the way that he's, you know, treated me. So yeah. I personally, it's something where like I personally just don't feel okay with it. But yeah, I mean, it's just, for me, he's kind of like almost like a secondary sort of, I guess, mentor person I look up to as an instructor. There's other people I look up to and admire, but it's just not the same.
Gotcha.
Which, I mean, it's kind of, I think, with going into your relationship with Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, that's exactly how I would describe my relationship with Abernathy. That he, and, you know, what I was talking about just a second ago, that it kind of, recognize there. It's funny, actually, a small tangent. I would say that Lyoto Machida was actually a very big influence for me, and somebody that I'm grateful for that he went out there and did his thing, because, you know, he was a karate guy who had a lot of success in the MMA game, and he got me into MMA. And once I kind of got my foot in the door and I started, you know, kind of learning about and watching a lot of MMA, I start to realize that, like, you know, it's kind of, it made me a lot more uncomfortable with the idea that I've never done any kind of grappling, kind of functional grappling anyway. There was some limited grappling in the stuff that I did growing up doing Tung Sudo. And in a funny way, that's what really led me to start attending Ian's seminars. Was he was a guy, and he has a very self-defense based approach to karate, as in, it's, you know he's not the guy to go to if you want to learn how to, you know, be how to outfight another trained martial artist. He kind of, he focuses very much on the kind of training that's appropriate for the dealing with a criminal assault.
Yeah.
But, and unsurprisingly, you know, he has a lot of grappling that's a part of what he does, because it's an essential skill that you really need for any kind of realistic combat. Whether you're talking about MMA, I would call that, as far as sports go, it's as realistic as it gets.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the combat is just two people fighting. There are things that are illegal, of course, but, you know, it's just kind of the art of human fighting. And then self-defense-wise, I mean, because self-defense is such an interesting, you know, kind of, like problem to address, I mean, like, really, like, anything can happen in a criminal assault. Obviously, you want to have a well-rounded skill set that's, you know, able to deal with a lot of, you know, different potential scenarios like that. So Ian was the guy who really, you know, Master Kremen gave me a very firm foundation to work from. I grew up training with him, I still train with him, and he's, in terms of the physical development and the ability that he gave me to generate power with my strikes and how, you know, difficult and grueling his classes were, and how that, you know, created a lot of, you know, mental toughness and the ability to overcome some adversity and reach, you know, goals. Like, those are, you know, invaluable skills that really set the foundation for who I am as a martial artist and as a person. And I can't, you know, words can't really describe the amount of gratitude that I have for, you know, the experiences that I got being his student. But Ian kind of took it to the next level for me, that it was more that he broadened my horizons a lot and made me understand that martial arts was so much bigger than just what I had done growing up.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he had a radically different approach to training that had a very different, because, you know, his methods had a very different focus to them. It wasn't just about physical development or about out fighting another karate guy, you know, in like a karate type like point competition. It was about, like, okay, you know, like, let's talk about what criminal assaults are like and what are, you know, methods that are appropriate to deal with those kinds of situations. And he ties it all back to, you know, the karate kata, which is unique thing about his method is that you know, if you go back, and if you're familiar with karate history, I mean, grappling was always a part of karate. It went through a bit of a transition in the early 1900s when karate became very popular. It was brought to mainland Japan and was taught in the university systems. And in my opinion, it developed a little bit of a symbiotic relationship with judo. You know,
yeah.
Judo taught throwing and joint locking. And, you know, so therefore karate was like, we teach striking, we teach something that judo doesn't do,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like that. So that, like, nobody was really interested in the grappling that karate guys were doing. So, you know, he has, and of course, you know, karate is a very big martial art and there's a wide range of practice, and there are plenty of people that always did the grappling and can continue to do it up till today. But he was the guy that kind of pieced it together for me. And, showed that, you know, these are things that were part of karate tradition that aren't going to apply to modern karate competitions, which is what I really trained for, you know, most of my life. And he took those things and said, and this is why they were a part of karate, because, you know, karate tournaments are totally modern. You know, it's like,
yeah,
this art existed way before that. And it was based on, you know, kind of like self-defense, that you get attacked in a criminal context, what do you do? So Ian really broadened my horizons and helped me to, you know, I'm standing on the foundation that Master Kremen gave me. And then Ian kind of showed me what the possibilities were and the places you can go with your martial arts training.
Yeah.
And that's led me down the path where I feel like I'm continuing to really develop a method of practice that's very much uniquely my own. That's, you know, it's my own. I have my own methods and my own approach to karate practice that, you know, aren't are very different than the way anybody else does it. It's uniquely mine, and that's something I really appreciate about my training, is that it has that, it's given me that kind of creative element to it, that I'm not just trying to learn what other people do in that way, that I've become kind of my own practitioner, where I'm trying to develop my own unique methods and take what, you know, of course the training I've done with you is a part of that too. I've talked about it on here before, that, you know, I think a really big thing for karate people to start integrating is just that basic groundwork, not the kind of stuff that you would practice to out grapple, you know, another submission grappler, but just from a self-defense context, you find yourself on the ground. How do I protect myself from getting, you know, knocked out? And how do I get back to my feet? That's the kind of thing that I think that, you know, everyone should do, no matter what style of martial art that you practice. And it was very much Ian's influence that brought me to that point.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back continuing this conversation. All right, we're back. So I'm going to kind of... talk about some people that were influential to me that are not martial arts people. And most of that stuff comes back to music. But I think one thing that's always interesting is like thinking about maybe like a person that maybe had a small window of frame as far as time in your life that had a huge influence on you. And one for me is I actually had an English teacher in high school named Mr. Neary, and he was like 23 years old. Just graduated from college, first job, and was just filling in as a substitute for that year because the teacher was, I don't know, taking a year off or sick or something like that. And I don't know, I was being rebellious at the time, and I was reading the assignments but not doing any of the homework. And then during class, I would like talk about the things because he was having us read some interesting things. And at some point he pulled me aside and was like, you're obviously doing the readings, but you're not doing the homework, you know, so like you're just being stupid. What are you doing? So that part was influential. But one of the things that was really influential for me at the time was pretty much like listening to like 90s alternative grunge rock type stuff. And like, probably the only other thing I was really listening to was maybe like Guns N' Roses. So I was like listening to Guns N' Roses, Alice in Chains, Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, Stone Temple Pilots. And he gave me a Prince record, or I don't remember if he gave it to me or he recommended it. And I ended up getting Prince's Purple Rain. I must have been like 14 or 15 at the time. And then that kind of led me down a path of being like, it's okay for me to not like these bands that are in this similar thing. I can listen to anything and just enjoy it. And I mean, who knows, if I hadn't had him, maybe I would have not graduated from high school, not gone to Drexel for college, not have a bachelor's degree from Drexel. So, I mean, he kind of gave me like a kick in the pants as far as getting myself back in line academically, but also kind of like had this influence on me musically. And I don't even think he played music. I don't even know how much he liked Prince, but it's a weird thing where like he kind of got me into that. And then, I mean, even at that point, music was a huge part of my life. I was already playing at that point. But then the music thing, you know, was pretty much dominated my high school, college years, and then post-college for a really long time. And I've been in the band Rosetta since 2003. That's like 17 years of my life. So, you know, that's a huge chunk of time. And I really haven't toured much the last 5 years, and pretty much haven't toured at all now, I guess. I don't know if it's, I guess it's 3 years ago is when I went to Japan. The thing that I got from those guys, which is four other people, Eric, Matt, BJ, and Armine, is this understanding and idea of how powerful collaboration is. Mm-hmm. So the influence that those guys have had on me is just massive, because it's like like, I don't even think we're friends. It's more of like a family sort of thing. It's not that we're not friends, but it's more like a family vibe when you've created something with these people and traveled the world and been in close quarters for them for just such a long period of time.
Sure.
But this idea of like when you find people that you collaborate well with and can like push each other's creative limits, it's something that's hard to find. And once you find it, it's something that's worth fighting to keep.
Yeah.
You know, you know, like we still make music to this day, even though that I don't really tour with those guys anymore, and they still tour and carry the torch there. But, you know, it's the same thing happens in martial arts.
And everything, yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So it's like most things are best done in collaboration. And when you find people that you collaborate well with, it's worth fighting to keep those people in your life. So actually last night, there's two guys that are the main two training partners I have. One guy's name is Ross, the other guy's name is Don. Don's life has made it so right now it's a little harder for him to get to class regularly.
Mm-hmm.
We live trained, we sparred for 40 minutes straight. We were just going to go until somebody caught a submission. We went 40 minutes straight.
Cool.
And we used to do stuff like that all the time. We would just grab each other and we would just train for like 20 minutes straight, 30 minutes straight, an hour straight, whatever, however long it took somebody to catch the other person. Well, that doesn't happen very often anymore. So it's like when you have that person there and you have the chance to, and that's what it was. I mean, great training is kind of like almost like having a debate.
Yeah.
Where a great conversation where you're going back and forth with each other and both people are contributing. Those are the best training sessions. The best training sessions aren't where you go and you tear through somebody and just crush them. It's the best training sessions are where you're kind of giving back and forth energy and moves with each other and exchanging ideas in that way. You know, like this idea of collaboration is something that I found a lot through music.
Yeah.
And again, that relationship with those guys in my band, which has been hugely, hugely influential.
Oh, man, I almost feel like the idea even goes to the point that it's like you can't avoid, it's always a collaboration.
Well, it is.
You know what I mean? It
is and it isn't. So, like, I mean, and I think you can speak to this. In jiu-jitsu, it almost always is because there's not a lot of solo drilling you can do.
Yeah.
But you can just do karate solo drills and kata.
You can.
Bag work,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
But that's not where
you're not
going to
experience the most growth. But
yeah.
Again, that some people don't even care about that. And again, we've talked about this before. People have different reasons for training and different motivations for training.
I usually think music is a really good example of this, that, you know, like you have the concept of genres, right? And you'll have key artists within genres, but none of them are really isolated. It's always the idea that, you know, there's kind of a culture that manifests around a certain kind of music, and then you have a lot of different people that are contributing to it, and they're giving it their own specific flavor to it.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned alternative bands. You know, it's like all the bands that you listed, it's like there's similarities between them. That was music I was into a lot as a teenager,
yeah,
too.
You know,
some
of that stuff actually gets, I think some of the similarities gets overstated.
Sure.
So the alternative rock thing, really the Seattle sound is a great example.
Yeah.
Because Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, and Alice in Chains are the four bands. And then there's a couple other artists in there that kind of came for that time period, like the Screaming Trees and Mudhoney and the Melvins.
Sure.
None of those bands actually sound the same.
Well, not the same, but I'm not familiar with all those bands. I was very into Nirvana when I was younger, so I'm a little bit,
again, as somebody who has played music for a long period of time.
Sure.
And I've dissected and listened to those bands a lot. What makes it weird and it's kind of cool is that those bands got grouped together as a sound called grunge,
mm-hmm,
but not a single one of those bands actually sound anything really similar.
Yeah, it's kind
of interesting. There's a little bit of crossover between some of them,
yeah,
but like the big four, which is Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and Alice in Chains, not a single one of those bands sound the same, yet they were grouped into the same genre.
Oh, there are other bands, like I was really into the Pixies, and I see a pretty clear connection between the Pixies and Nirvana.
It's not that there's not similarities between some of those bands. Like, I mean, so Smashing Pumpkins, sounds a lot like I can't sounds a lot like My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
And you can hear how My Bloody Valentine
yeah.
was probably a direct like influence for Billy Corgan to shift to the sound of
definitely
Smashing
yeah.
Pumpkins. So it's not that that doesn't exist, but my point is that what was considered the big four grunge bands that were
yeah.
from the Seattle and the Seattle sound,
yeah.
none of those four bands that are considered the Seattle sound actually
sure.
sounded anything alike.
Yeah, well, you always hear that too with Pearl Jam, that, you know, Pearl Jam and Nirvana being like the two big grunge bands, and they sound very different. There was a band that I've...
Yeah, and what's even crazier, what's crazy within that is that, so Pearl Jam and Nirvana were the two more popular bands, but the bands that really paved the way from those Seattle bands were more so Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. They were the two that had... Alice in Chains was the band that had the first sort of major label
gotcha.
Hit album with
yeah.
Facelift, and then Soundgarden, I think that they were signed maybe to a major label first and put out a major label album before Alice in Chains' album, but it wasn't super successful until
yeah.
Bad Motorfingers, when they really broke through and became more popular.
Gotcha.
And then Pearl Jam was actually a band called Mother Love Bone,
mm-hmm.
who was signed to a major label, and the singer overdosed on drugs before and died before the band actually released the album, and the album
yeah.
never went anywhere. But that band was almost like a glam rock band.
Yeah.
And Alice in Chains, before they sort of shifted their sounds, they were a little bit of like
sure.
like an 80s hair metal band vibe.
Yeah, because there was kind of a transition from
yeah,
one genre
and
to the
Nirvana
other.
Nirvana was yeah. almost coming more from, because they grew up around the Melvins, they were coming more from like, hey, we want to be like the Melvins doing this weird, dirty, punk rock, sludgy, dirty sound.
Yeah.
You know, and then the Soundgarden guys, they were kind of, again, they were like punk rock kids
yeah.
to a certain extent. And I don't even know if people know this, but one of the, so... Soundgarden is I think might have been the like first or second release ever on Sub Pop Records, but their first full length was actually on SST Records, which is the record label that the guitar player / mastermind of Black Flag owned. So those, they have roots that are really rooted in punk rock. But yeah, you know, it's like I say this all the time. There's really only two genres of music. Good music or bad music, or music
yeah.
you like and music you don't like.
Sure.
And that same sort of approach should be for martial arts.
Yeah,
there's techniques that are valuable, and those might just be individual to the person, but there's techniques that are overall have value versus techniques that don't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's good and bad techniques. You don't have to pigeonhole it as like being like, I'm only going to work on Muay Thai because Muay Thai is the only thing I care about. You're allowed
yeah.
to have this... But again,
sure.
it's a very much an American thing, is this idea of needing to label everything,
reductionism,
put it in a nice,
reduce it to
yeah,
this,
yeah,
yeah,
and put it in this nice little box.
Sure.
And
yeah,
fit it into this nice little box.
I just feel like, and it's actually something that's cool about MMA, too, that just, you know, the concept of collaboration is just, I mean, it's the way to go. And it's always, no man is an island. Right, you know,
yeah.
it's like none of this, nothing of worth is really ever developed in isolation. I consider it actually kind of like a big myth a lot of the time, the idea that you have the genius working alone who's, you know, going to create this thing that's going to change the world. I think the reality is it's almost always a collaboration of many different people that build upon each other's accomplishments, and that's how you create real innovation.
Yeah.
In the martial arts. And I think that's where we would, you know, certainly agree that, you know, we've talked about it with jiu-jitsu before, that, you know, you kind of have the Gracies who are definitely key players
yeah.
in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. However, you know, there were, it was a movement, you know, it's the, I forget his
yeah,
name,
yeah.
Maeda. Is that the...
Yeah, Maeda.
Maeda.
Yeah.
You know, judo guy who came to Brazil, taught a lot of different people, and that's why you have, you know, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu being somewhat separate from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because there was a movement that created this
yeah,
you know, different
I mean,
style
so
of grappling.
There's a lot of... That's a whole nother conversation, because...
Sure.
Some of it is just marketing strategies to call it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu versus Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Definitely, yeah.
But yeah, there's another lineage from Brazil that does jiu-jitsu. I think it's like I'm probably going to butcher his name. It's like Osvaldo Fado or something like that. I probably don't have the name right. But I think that there is... So the team that Jose Aldo and Henan Barral and BJ Penn are a part of are from that lineage. Gotcha. So that's a non-Gracie jiu-jitsu lineage. So Maeda came to Brazil, and that's one of the other lineages of people that he taught Japanese jiu-jitsu to.
Yeah.
Took it and did their own thing with it. But even, again, within that context, there's all these other people that made their moves and made their modifications and spread it outside the Gracie family.
And the influence of things like Vale Tudo, that, you know, like there was a competitive format that I think had existed prior to that, where, you know, like the idea being that you had grapplers who were applying what they were doing to, you know, something that was more like real fighting rather than just grappling matches.
You know? Yeah, so. I forget where I read this, but that stuff was kind of always going on, but it was just being labeled differently. And I think that they, like, if you look at some of the history, I think that there was kind of like these strongmen competitions that were like almost catch wrestling matches that were kind of like doing some of the no holds bar. And obviously there's pancration too, but that's a little bit, it's similar actually, you know, so there's actually lots of history that shows that the Vale Tudo sort of thing was going on, but it kind of got lost because you originally had the pancration thing and then it kind of, that went away. But like you would have these fights which were maybe staged or not staged at carnivals and circuses and fairs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the Vale Tudo idea in Brazil brought it back to more like the pancration thing of making it into this huge spectacle and event.
Yep. Okay.
You know? But again, that's we can spend a whole
sure. Yeah, that's another
yeah, whole
can episode of worms to get into. So other influential people that feel that I should mention is other people that are part of my karate organization. Mike Campanini is the guy who runs another AMCOR school, which is the group that I'm a part of. He started teaching for my instructor back when I was first, you know, kind of starting to pursue martial arts as a full-time thing. And I consider him really influential for me because he kind of showed that the path that I wanted to go down of trying to be an instructor is like it was something he was already doing and he was a little bit farther along on it than I was. So it gave me a sense of direction that, you know, was something that I could experience success with and that I could get to. So, you know, I'm grateful that I had him around me when I was a little bit younger because I think it really made me feel stronger in my position. Erica Tierney, similar situation. You know, she actually is the daughter of the founder of our organization, Frederick Scott. And, you know, she had taken over the full-time teaching position at the headquarters school. And, you know, similar kind of thing where she was, you know, becoming a teacher, you know, in her own right and, you know, pursuing this. It was kind of like I saw when I was, you know, like my late teen years, 18, 19 years old, when I got serious about pursuing martial arts as a career, you know, I kind of saw that there was a little bit of like a new generation of instructors coming up in my group, and that gave me a sense of the community and identity in it, that it's like I'm not alone in this, there are other people that are also pursuing this and also doing this. So those are people I'm definitely grateful for. And the last person I want to talk about is actually someone not related to martial arts at all, that a academic whose work has been a really big influence on my life is a guy named Joseph Campbell. And he kind of spearheaded what they call comparative mythology now. And he wrote a very, very famous book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It essentially was a comparative study of different hero myths across world cultures. And trying to, and you know, he was illustrating the concept of the monomyth, the idea that the hero story always goes through has a pattern to it, that no matter what, you know, hero story that we're talking about, that there's always a general pattern that it goes through, and that those patterns mirror the path that you go through in your own life. And it's all about, you know, his work really helped me to understand my own capacity for transformation, that the person that I am today is not the person that I will be in the future, that things are always changing, whether we want them to or not. And it's kind of up to you to, you know, try to influence them and have them change for the better. So, you know, the transition, I'm sure you have similar experiences too, yeah, becoming a teacher. And of course, you had a career as a musician before you got into martial arts, a little bit of a difference of ours, where I kind of went from being a child to, you know, kind of pursuing martial arts full time. But it really helped me, his work and, you know, the books of his that I read really helped me, I think, to grow in a healthy way during those years when I was trying to find, you know, my identity as an instructor, where I went from like a teenager to a guy who, to, you know, a teacher who, you know, parents were leaving their children with me and, yeah, you know, yeah, trusting me to, you know, not only to, you know, for them to be safe, you know, when they're at the school with me, that I, me being in charge of them, but also that I was going to instruct them and that it was going to be something that was worth the money that they were paying for the instruction, yeah, with it. You know, when you're a 19-year-old kid, that's kind of something that's a little bit intimidating, where it's suddenly like, wow, that's actually like, I'm in charge of this whole situation here. And it was something that took a little bit of growth on my part to get to the point that I felt comfortable in that position. And then, yeah, you take the same process and I can apply it to what I've tried to do with broadening my skill set and trying to create my own method of practice, is that it's all about that idea of personal transformation and growth. Or as, you know, somebody like Campbell would put it, is symbolically represented in a lot of traditional myths, is like the death and rebirth. The idea that, you know, you have to let the person that you are die so that you can be reborn as the person that you could be. And I felt that that was something that, not only for martial arts, but just life in general, is such an essential thing that people kind of understand about themselves, that you have this capacity to change and to grow as a person. And being aware of it and even able to direct that growth and change, I think, is really what makes the difference between having a happy, successful life and a miserable, you know, like,
yeah,
a miserable, sad life. And that's something that, you know, I was young when I first was exposed to Joseph Campbell, and he had an effect on me like no other kind of intellectual I've ever run into before. He really made me understand that I can be the hero of my story. You know, like I can be a hero and my life can be an adventure, yeah, if I approach it that way. And that's powerful ideas that I've really tried to take with me in my life.
Yeah, I always think that's, I mean, there's, again, going back to people putting things in a box, just people so often just look at like the things that they think are directly linked to the same thing that they're doing. So it's like, oh, if I do jujitsu, it should only be jujitsu people influencing me, but it should, yeah, be, yeah, a wide array of different things.
Definitely, yeah.
And again, people don't know what's going to influence them. Like, I had a friend in high school who played me The Cure, and The Cure is one of the biggest influences for me as far as writing music in Rosetta, but it's not like, it's a band I like, but not a band I love.
Yeah.
But like, as far as like what they do, it's super like, I don't know, I feel a connection when I'm being creative with music towards how they play it and how they write their songs to how I contribute to writing my parts, you know? It's just a random chance thing. I don't even know if when I was over at this friend's house, if they even liked The Cure that much.
Yeah.
Or if they just put it on and it was like, oh, what's this, you know? There's so many little moments like that, yeah, where you know, and I don't think, yeah, I don't know if people ever think about things like that.
Yeah. Oh, it's funny. You know, get me thinking about it a little bit, that like, you know, you don't have to absolutely love something for there to be a very important kind of idea there that you can take,
yeah, yeah,
from it. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, you might change. I think a lot of like, especially with something like music, it has a lot to do with the aesthetics of it. Like, you know, you just really like the sound of that band, you, yeah, know, but maybe there's like something in the lyrics with that band that sticks with you.
Yeah.
You take that and, you know, like, and that it ends up being really influential. Doesn't mean it's your favorite band, you know, because other things you might like about other bands more, but there's just that, and maybe it's even just a time and place. You were just kind of in the right mindset at that moment
when
you heard that idea that hit you in the right way.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Random element to life. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it. Enjoy the end of the year. Enjoy your holidays.
Yeah. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And we'll be back in 2020 with a lot of good stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, and get out there and train. Yeah.